There are many constants to gardening, choosing the right plants for our growing conditions and then keeping them watered and fed and weed-free. But every season, of course, brings its unique challenges. And, of course, last year we had, what, heat, extreme heat and drought. This year we got off to a slow start because of cool, wet conditions. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Whether you're a new gardener or you're an old hand at it, it's great to be able to get advice from the experts, and Ed Lyon is certainly an expert. He's director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. Been with us many times on Garden Talk. And Ed Lyon, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure to be here, Larry.
We have, and you're, and I've had a chance to visit the garden, the Allen Centennial Garden. It is just popping. I mean, it is beautiful.
We're very happy. Considering the spring that we started out with, we couldn't be happier with the way things are looking right now.
It's well worth a visit if you're in the Madison area to see the gardens. That's for sure. And I think as we look across the state at the flower gardens in particular, they're pretty good growing conditions pretty much across the state.
Yeah, I think some of the challenges we started with the cool, wet, we've seen more powdery mildew than we've seen. In fact, we've just cut all the peonies way back because they were just covered with it this year. Yeah. Pulmonarias, cut them right to the ground. And initially, some of your heat lovers, like basil in particular, was very difficult not to have that rot off on you. But otherwise, when you look at things like perennials, I've never seen a better hosta year. The hostas have just
beautiful.
Exploded. Yeah. So, you know, it's like any year, there's certain plants that actually preferred those conditions, even though they were challenging for us.
We have some callers online already. If you'd like to join in, maybe you have a question about your garden, or maybe you would like to share some of your own stories about it, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo and or question on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can do that. Tristan in Brown Deer is up here first, so let's go to Tristan. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Well, I have an anthill in my yard, and we've tried seriously, like, everything. It's about, like, a two-foot circle, and we've got many kinds of poison, but they always come back after it's, like, washed away or whatever. Do you have any suggestions how to get rid of it for good?
Are they doing damage in some way?
Well, they've just been, like, building a humongo anthill that's, like, too big.
Well, I'll tell you, I am probably one of the advocates of not killing insects that aren't doing any damage in any way. So usually when people are talking about ants, it might be because they're in an area where it's destroying the perennials and the perennial garden. Personally, my opinion is if there are insects that are not harming you in any way, they're part of the ecosystem. First off, I'd find out what kind of ants they are, the poisons that you are putting on them to kill them. If they're not doing any damage, may also be poisoning other beneficial insects at the same time. So I have to say I'm a real advocate of first finding out what the insect is. Is it something that is actually damaging? Other than it's just an annoyance that there's this anthill there, and then take it from there. I'm just not an advocate of throwing out all these poisons out there simply because it's an insect and we perceive them as somehow harmful.
Yeah, and frankly, with an anthill like that, if poisons are applied, they're typically not applied deep enough to really do the job. Anyway, you really need to, if you were going to get rid of the nest, you'd really need to get, you know, down a few feet.
Yeah, and it's probably better to just make the conditions non-conducive to them having a hill. That can be, you know, flooding the area for a certain amount of time, and then they're going to decide that that's not an ideal location for the hill and relocate.
Yep. Good point. So flooding might be one way to do it and not involve chemicals.
Yeah, correct. Or if it's not a lawn or an area like that, cover it with a piece of plastic or black plastic for just a limited amount of time until, again, they feel it's uncomfortable and they move.
Yep. There you go. Thanks, Tristan, for calling. Appreciate it. David in Milltown, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Howdy, gentlemen.
Hi.
I have a question on fertilizer with my vegetable garden. I started it with some with seedlings, some with already pre-started plants. It's got good sun, good drainage, and I put on some all-purpose fertilizer, which I did last year, too, after the plants were already developed around kind of the base of each plant. I have an assortment of vegetables, and in a couple of days, a lot of them were completely dead, you know, withered up, and some of them did way better, like the zucchinis and some cantaloupes, the beans, strawberries, those just shot up even better. And a lot of the other ones, like peas and some other watermelons, cucumbers, some tomatoes, they all died. So my question is, what did I do wrong? Why did it work last year, not this year? And how can I reverse those effects? Some of those plants are just kind of alive. How can I save them?
Well, we'll address that first. If they're only just kind of alive, you're probably not going to save them. It's not going to be worth it. They're probably so damaged at this point that even trying to bring them back, they're not going to yield for you. So your best bet is simply to replace them at this point. Obviously, it sounds like you over-fertilized, got the fertilizer too close to the plants. The other thing is you said a balanced fertilizer. And usually when people say balance, they mean like a 15-15-15, 20-20-20, something of that nature. And we never advocate using those fertilizers that are balanced in that way. Plants take up nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium at different rates. And it seems logical, oh, let's put down an equal balance of all of those. But what happens is the plants take up the nitrogen far faster, far easier than they do the phosphorus or potassium. Plus, plants don't need nearly the phosphorus or potassium. So what's happening is they're not taking up those elements to begin with, and that's leaching into the soil, and that's what causes those problems. So I certainly would avoid that. And if you're using an inorganic fertilizer, like I said, it sounds like you're burning those plants. You're putting too much on. I would go away from the inorganic fertilizers. I'd look at getting good compost in your garden. That's the best possible fertility you can give plants in the first place, because that's what plants utilize. There's nobody out there in nature, giant hand sprinkling inorganic fertilizer mm-hmm. on things. And then I would go to things like kelp or seaweed or some of the fish emulsions. Again, I think you're just overdoing nutrition on plants that just simply don't need that kind of nutrient level that you're putting on them.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Good luck. Thanks for calling. I was thinking about our lime tree, which my daughter has named Limey. Limey has all kinds of limes, and we're using a fish emulsion and fertilizer from time to time, and it seems to work really well.
Yeah, it's better to use something low-grade and organic of that nature more often than throwing a lot of inorganic fertilizer down all at once.
Yeah. John in Door County, we turn to you next. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I have a problem with crown vetch around my flower gardens, and I have it out in the open. Could you tell me how I could eradicate this? I'm going to hang up and get you on the phone. Thank you.
Yeah,
crown vetch isn't going to be easy to eradicate, and we have issues with certain weeds at the gardens where we know we can work at it and work at it, and I can ask the poor volunteers to go out there, and bindweed is especially bad for us in thistles. There comes a point where if a weed like that becomes a issue for you, particularly in beds, you may have to start over. And that's a hard piece of advice to give to people. But certainly if we're talking like a perennial bed, something of that nature, try to dig out the plants that you think you can save. Make sure that none of the weed that you're trying to eliminate is coming with it. But you may literally be a plants like that, and once they become an issue, you may have to go right back to ground zero and eradicate it. And it might take a chemical being used appropriately. It's, certainly follow the instructions and start over again. I know Crown Vetch can be very, very difficult once it's established.
Michelle in Arcadia, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I'm trying to grow broccoli this year for the first time in several years. So I bought some plants and put them in the ground about the 20th of May, and they stood there doing nothing for quite a while because it was wet and cold, but then they took off, and they went to tops. No heads of broccoli, just the yellow-flowered tops. So I cut those off at the advice of a friend who grows broccoli regularly, and that was maybe a couple of weeks ago, and I noticed they're going to tops again. Is there anything that can be done about this?
It's rather interesting because usually what makes a broccoli go to top is heat, and you know, because they are a very cool-season plant, and they don't like a lot of heat. That's the only thing that I can think of is somehow they were getting, about the time they should start forming those heads must have been right about the time we got that excess heat, and the heat pushed them faster than it should have. Maybe one of our other callers who does a lot of broccoli can tell you. Now, we just cut some broccoli heads off at the gardens, because we have an extensive edible garden there, and we noticed they were tougher this year, the heads on the broccoli. So I don't think it's been an especially great year for that particular plant.
Yeah.
Is it possible that once they've been cut back, I might get some heads again? Or
well, they tend to put more out to the side, which are certainly edible, but you're not going to get the same yield that you get with that initial big floret that's right on top of the plant.
Okay.
And again, if it seems to be keep doing this to you, I'm kind of thinking it will continue to do that. Again, and there might be some difference in the variety as well. I'm not sure about that. Mm. One of the things we've been doing with many of our brassicas, because broccoli's in that family, we've been doing vertical gardening at Allen Centennial Gardens. And we have these angled trellises that we do our squash up so that the squash takes up less space. And we have found it's the perfect place to then grow our cabbages, our Brussels sprouts, our broccolis, because there's just enough shade to keep them cooler when you get into the heat of the summer, but they're getting enough of that sunlight that they like as well. One of the problems with all of those plants in that family is we turned hot very, very suddenly, and those plants just don't like a lot of heat.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Facebook question from Brianna wants some advice on what she can plant in her garden right now. Thanks to some hungry rabbits, of which we have plenty here in Wisconsin this year. Thanks to hungry rabbits, I've got a few bare spaces and I don't want weeds to take over.
Yeah, well, that would have, and rabbits have been horrendous this year. We've had literally, I would say, thousands of dollars of damage at the gardens, because and nothing seems to be working this year. But what, as far as planting things, it depends on whether you're looking at perennials. And you can plant perennials at any time. That's not an issue at all. In fact, I've been out to the flower factory probably 6 or 7 times just recently, adding and doing exactly what you're talking about, where plants have failed at the gardens, where running out and getting perennials. Certainly annuals will fill those spaces. Now, here's something that I recommend, and we just filled some holes at the gardens, and I did not want to go and get annuals that have not sold at this point, because they're probably in flats and very root-bound at this point. So what I did is we went and we bought plants that were in large pots and hanging baskets.
Oh,
because they're not root-bound. And then we take them out of the baskets and divide them up, and they're actually healthier, better plants than if you were to go get something that's been sitting and root bound by this time in the season.
Yeah, my wife did that too within the last week or so. We have a Facebook question from Andrea in New London. I cut my rose bush back last year and I think I killed it because the stalks are brown. A couple of green ones, but no growth.
Well, if they're still brown now, you've got a dead plant there. Yeah, and very often I don't know what kind of rose you have, but many roses are grafted on a wild stock to begin with. So what green shoots you have could very well be from the rootstock and not the original rose in the first place. And I would say by this time in the summer, if all you have are a few little green shoots, it's just time to replace that plant.
We're going to talk more about keeping our gardens healthy and productive right now after a short break. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the flower garden, a little about the vegetable garden today, just how to keep your garden growing healthy on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Ed Lyon. Ed is director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, those gardens located on the UW-Madison campus. And I'm telling you what, it is a beautiful, beautiful garden this year. Well, it always is. It's a fun place to visit. You can go online to the Allen Centennial Gardens. There's a website. And frankly, we have on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, we've got a link to the Allen Centennial Gardens. I hope you'll take a look at it, click on it. And then when you're in Madison or in the area, please stop and take a look, because they're always happy to see folks stop by and enjoy the gardens. In the meantime, if you have a question about your garden, what's going on with your flowers or vegetables perhaps, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Have open lines so we can get you on really quickly here with your questions or comments. We have an email, and by the way, you can email us at talk@wpr.org. or on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. But let's take an email question from Mary in West Bend. Our magnolia tree was stunning this year. However, the catkins are now dropping at a record rate. This has never happened before. The tree has been in place for 10 years or so and very well suited to its site. What do you think, Ed?
Well, I've noticed magnolias seem to be under stress. We have one right now that's quite chlorotic. And when we say chlorotic, we mean it's not taking up enough iron, so the foliage becomes gold or yellow. So I just applied some iron to that, and I noticed the same thing. One of the things I think we're going to find issues with, and we were telling everybody last year, that drought has far-reaching implications. So I think we're going to see a lot more issues, particularly with trees. They may not have shown during the drought last year. Now we follow that with a year where essentially those root systems may have been overly wet, overly cool all through the spring. So we've thrown two enormous challenges at these trees 2 years in a row. And it's my suspicion it's probably a combination of some leftover effects from the drought last year and the fact that we had less than ideal conditions with overly saturated soils this year.
Yeah. I think you're exactly right.
And we've told people when we have a drought that severe, we can see issues for 2 or 3 years, well beyond that.
Carlin in Genesee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I've got a question. It's kind of a genetic kind of question, possibly, about squash.
Okay.
I had a really wonderful butternut squash come up last year in a bed, and I also had some zucchini in there and some pumpkin down at one end, but the butternut were the ones that really did really great.
Sean.
Well, this year, as we tilled it under and all, and then in the spring, I saw volunteer squash plants coming up. So I was hoping, these are going to be either zucchini or butternut, or maybe even pumpkins. I didn't care. They were really great. They were vigorous. They're wonderful, and they're still beautiful. But now they're like flowering, and what they're forming are these weird little gourds that have, they've got like a long neck and a thick bottom and then like those 10 points or something that they kind of stick. I don't know what, mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with gourds. But it seems to me, so these were volunteers, right? So these were like from the plants last year.
That's what you're talking about is exactly what you said. It's genetics. Many of these vegetables are hybrids.
Right.
And so hybrids are not going to come back true from seed. In order to get that hybrid, you have to have that same exact set of parents and create that same exact genetic material. So what you got was some kind of an odd and interesting cross, maybe even between more than two different plants that you had. I learned that at an early age. I grew up on a farm in upstate New York, and we had what we called manure piles. We couldn't get into the fields in the winter, so we had these piles of nice compost manure, and I planted pumpkins and Hubbard squash. Well, just like you, the next year I had these volunteers, and I had an interesting cross between the two. So that's what's happening. And again, if you want a very specific variety of plant, then you have to buy the new seed every year.
Yeah. Oh, bummer.
Yeah, you got to know who both parents are.
Yeah. So I should rip these out and replant, hey?
Yes. Yeah. Well, unless
you want to try and see what they wind up looking like.
You know, this happened in a previous year. The year before last, same thing came out of our compost. And they were great gourds for Halloween, but, you know, kind of weird looking things, but I don't know. I wanted food.
Well, that's what keeps our seed companies in business, is they're producing that seed and they have the parents to do
all
that.
All right, so rip out the volunteers. Too bad they're always the healthiest.
That's true.
Thanks, Garland.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye bye. Appreciate it. She's right. They are pretty healthy usually and kind of fun to keep one or, you know, if you got the room just to see how they turn out. Fran in Grafton, hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for your program.
Sure.
I planted last year a honeysuckle vine next to our little arbor, and it was doing beautifully early this year, flowered and everything. And now the leaves are turning yellow and getting brown around the outside edges, and the flowers aren't doing so well.
Look at the leaf, and if it's yellow with green veins, that's a chlorotic problem. And chlorosis is extremely easy to identify. I'm kind of thinking it may not be, because really Lonicera shouldn't have too much of an issue with iron uptake. But if that's what you have, it's a yellow or gold leaf with green veination, then it's chlorosis and very easy to fix with applying some chelated iron. But another issue that I don't think people realize this year, all of that rain that we've had is leaching nutrients out of the soil.
Yeah.
Even those of us that have really good organic matter in our beds, that constant rain leaches out fertility. So it may be as simple as needing a little bit more fertility. I would not overdo it. What we're doing at the gardens is we're doing weekly applications right now of something fairly low grade on the nutrient level just to bring up some of that nutrition that we know has been getting leached this year.
Okay, so something like milorganite, is that too much?
No, milorganite's only 9% nitrogen, and if they're yellow and it is a nutrient issue, then it probably would be nitrogen. And the most likely, nitrogen leaches out fairly easily out of the soils, and maybe your plant just isn't accessing enough of that. And I think you'll be surprised that it'll be relatively quickly if you're giving it some of this. Mm-hmm. I think my first application would be something liquid, though, so that that plant can take it
right
up
away.
Fairly quickly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Fran. Thank you for calling. And Rebecca in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I've got two separate questions for you.
Okay.
The first one is a rose bush. I have a rose bush. It didn't flower for like 3 years. This year, there's tons of flowers all over it. I clipped off two of the canes that were hanging over the sidewalk. And I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but all of the leaves have dropped off.
Have dropped off what? The remaining bush?
the bush. Yeah.
Yeah. Clipping off the branches wouldn't have affected the rest of the bush at all.
Okay.
When you say they're dropping off, are they turning brown first and dropping? Are they dropping green? How are
yellow.
They dropping? So they're turning yellow and they're dropping.
So there are some, there are a few leaves left towards the top of the bush, but everything else has dropped off.
And what kind of roses? Shrub roses, tea roses, climbing roses?
I actually think that it was something else and I chopped it down too far. You know, whatever was grafted on there, a pretty like pinky, peachy, corally sort of flower. And I didn't get any flowers, and this year it's like a I don't know roses too much, but it's tons of little bright fuchsia
okay.
flowers.
I'm thinking we're still talking a too much water issue. Roses don't like their root systems in a lot of moisture. So I think it's probably a reaction to too much moisture. Again, as we said with the last caller, a lot of your nutrients are probably leaching, so the plant's not getting enough nitrogen as well. So if it drops off too many roses, leaves, you might not save it, because certainly it needs a certain amount of foliage to photosynthesize. I would start, is it in an area that you think is maybe a little more on the clay side and not real well drained?
It's all new dirt.
Well, new dirt doesn't, certainly a lot of what people bring in as they call topsoil, that's all it is. It doesn't have organic matter in it, and you don't get really good drainage. I think what I would do is sort of dig down around the plant and see if that soil is staying overly moist. That would be my first suspicion. Roses do not like excess moisture, and that would probably make those leaves drop off quickly as anything would.
Should I not mulch around it either?
Well, if that's the issue, it's going to need some drying out, certainly.
Yep.
So I'd get the mulch away from it. And then I would, like we advised our last caller, put something in liquid form that might bring up the nitrogen level. Be careful, don't overdo it, because you may, again, produce a whole nother shock to that plant. So something low-grade in nitrogen.
Good luck, Rebecca. Thank you for calling. And Jerry and Spooner, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Can you tell me how to prevent broccoli worms? I used to use a product called Garden Guard, which is off the market. It's got BT in it. And then I tried washing them off from underneath, and I couldn't really prevent it either. So organically would be nice, of course.
Well, I think there are still other products out there that have BT in them. BT's certainly hasn't been taken off the market or anything of that nature, and that probably would be your best bet. I would just whomever you are buying from as far as the garden center, ask them for an alternative product with a BT in it, because that really is the most effective method.
Yeah.
And sometimes we will use, and it's not quite as effective, we use a combination of Dawn dish liquid and Listerine in suspension. You can find a number of recipes online using them. It's basically you're making an insecticidal soap. But I can't imagine that you can't find another product with BT in it.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And while we're on broccoli, we were talking, someone called in and said, not getting any head formation. And Kyle shot us a note on my Facebook page and said there is a type of broccoli that does not form heads. Instead, there are loose florets.
Oh, well, maybe that's what she bought then.
She might have bought that and just not realized it. Frankly, I wouldn't have realized it myself.
Nope, I would have automatically, our mind usually tends to go to, oh, what kind of an insect or or disease or something. And sometimes it's very simple.
Yeah, sometimes it is. We had another Facebook from Pat said, yesterday I discovered a bad infestation of iris borer in my garden. Sorry, Pat. I suppose I take out all the irises and treat them, but what do I have to do with the soil? How long before I can plant iris there again?
Good old iris borer. Yeah, I would probably not replant the irises anytime soon. I'd let it leave fallow, not fallow, but put something else in there probably for another year or two.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, once those borers are in an area. And when you're planting those irises, if you're relocating them, several things really help. We have an iris garden. It's a donor-designated garden at Allen Centennial Gardens. Keep your, them the different, I say cultivars, if you prefer variety, keep them separated with some space. Certainly when you have irises anywhere near one another, the borers can travel very quickly. We have no borer issues, and we have a very, very large iris garden.
Yes.
And part of it is because we have our irises located in an area that's very hot, very dry, very well drained. The homeowner tends to put irises in their perennial garden, and they get crowded. They do not like other plants right around them. It adds to the moisture around the irises, and it makes the conditions more conducive to the borer. What irises really prefer is some separation, some hot weather, and very dry, well-drained soils, and that's the best. Your best control is cultural and where you put them.
Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk. Thanks for listening in. You can join us with your question at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Post a question or comment there. Connor in Blair up next with a question. Hi, Connor.
Hi. I've planted some delphiniums this year, and a few of them are doing very good, but a few of my other ones, the leaves are curling under, and then they're starting to get some black. It looks like they've almost been burned in a few places. Like the stem might have been like cut off somehow, and then it's kind of black around there. I was wondering if you might know what's happening.
Yeah, another moisture problem, yeah. I think. I mean, the first thing when leaves start to curl, you think an insect. But if they're turning black, to me, delphiniums hate water, and they hate it around their root systems. Down here, we have a heck of a time getting delphiniums to even survive the winter because they want very sandy, very gravelly, well-drained soils. So it sounds to me like you've got a fungal issue in those delphiniums. If you have other plants, if they're growing within other plants, that's probably holding in some moisture. We went into that real hot, humid climate. So I think you've got fungal spores in there.
Okay. Is there anything I could do, like get a certain fungicide or...
Fungicide isn't going to cure it. It'll help keep it from spreading. And certainly apply every 7 to 10 days, follow the instructions on it. Certainly, we've gone into some nice warmer temperatures. Make sure there are no other plants that are right up around them that would hold in additional moisture. And if it hasn't been severe damage, these warmer, drier days should definitely help.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good luck. Thanks, Connor. And by the way, someone mentioned Garden Guard a few minutes ago. Couldn't find it or thought it was no longer being made. And Karen called in and wanted to let folks know that Garden Guard has changed its packaging.
Uh-huh.
So it's now green and blue instead of the orange, which really kind of stuck out, the orange. So if you're still looking for Garden Guard, look for a green and blue package. That's a little different. Sally in Superior, hello.
Hello. I, for the fun of it, started some potatoes inside in March, and I've transplanted them 2-3 times, and they're now in my greenhouse, and they've, I think, produced a seed. There are little bunches of round balls hanging off of a bunch like grapes. Would that be the seeds?
You have got me. I have never heard of anybody starting potatoes indoors and then putting them in a greenhouse.
Oh, I've done it before, and you don't get big potatoes. You just get little ones. I've got the main crop in the greenhouse, but or outside. But just for the fun of it, you get little ones. You get nice little nuggets just to eat on in the winter.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And, you know, in all honesty, I can't say I've ever seen a potato go to seed, so I can't really accurately answer your question.
Because I was wondering, you know, when do I know if they're ripe?
Well, with almost all potatoes, you wait until the tops die back. That's what we do. In fact, I've noticed that the gardens, we're just starting to see a couple of the varieties are starting to die, and we let them die almost all the way back, and that's when we dig them. But that's if we're going to harvest all of those potatoes at the time we think they're all mature as well.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's, I just, you know, I've got four of them this way, and there's only one that's doing this.
Well, I'm sure one of our potato experts at the university could answer that question.
Yeah, I'm hoping one of them is listening in right now, because I don't know the answer to that one either. That's a good question. Sally, thanks.
Okay.
Stay listening. We'll see what we can come up with. We've got so many master gardeners listening in, too. There may be a master gardener with an answer to that as well. Tim in Whitewater. Hi, thank you for calling.
And thank you for having me on your show. I am no master gardener.
Okay.
My wife in the backyard has this beautiful purple bush. And to prove that I'm not a master gardener, I don't know the name of it, and I can't ask her. She's not available. But it's grown over the years to a beautiful size. It's very healthy. But last year, it was destroyed by these little devils, these Japanese beetles. I got some spray at a chain store and tried it, put it on, and did it one more time, and it didn't help. We ended up surrendering, and it just really ate the tree. And this year, it's grown back bigger than ever, and I was wondering if your guest could give me the name of a product, best time to use it. I know sometimes, you know, usually they tell you, you know, don't do it when it's wet and this and that, but the best product to put on it, when to put on it, and is it readily available?
First off, the big purple bush, is it the foliage that's purple, or does it have a purple flower?
There's no flowers. It's just the foliage.
It sounds like Physocarpus. Purple. I think you probably have one of the purple nine barks, and the Japanese beetles will go after the nine bark. Right now, there's nothing that you can do and put on it. There are no chemicals that you can put on the foliage that's going to prevent the Japanese beetles to eating it. The only effective chemical, quote unquote, are systemics. And systemics you put around the root system of that plant, but it has to have time to take up that systemic so it's up in the rest of that plant. And that would have had to been done in the spring. If you put systemic down on it now, that plant does not have enough time to take it up so that it will be effective. And sometimes the systemic isn't even all that effective. And as a matter of fact, with roses, it will work for the foliage, but it does not then transfer into the flower. Your best bet is what all the rest of us are doing. When the beetles come into that bush, you need to knock them into soapy water and kill them. And I know that's you want that magic elixir of a chemical that's going to deter them, and it simply does not exist.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they can blow in from a long ways away, and you can kill everyone that's on your plant today, and tomorrow you could have just as many from blown in from somewhere else.
And they're here. We've seen them over the last week, and I'm expecting we'll probably see the major population start here fairly soon.
Yeah.
Now, this has to be put on in the early spring. Is that what you're saying?
The systemic, yes. Because again, you're going to be wait.
Could you spell the word for me? Excuse me.
Well, that's not the name of the product. We call it any product that is taken up through the root systems of the plants. We call it systemic because it's going
systemic.
Through the. Yep, it's
systemic.
Going.
Yep, yeah, it's going, like system and ick.
Yeah, Bayer makes a pretty good product for that. There's a number of products out there that are systemics. So I'm not giving away a specific chemical name.
Yeah, there you go. Tim, thanks very much for calling. Good luck. I'm Larry Mueller, visiting today with Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, on this edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Ed Lyon. Ed is director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. I hope you'll go to my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. We've got a link to the gardens there, and also some photos and some things that you might enjoy taking a look at. So do that. And if you have a question, you can call at 800-642-1234. Roger Reynolds posted on our Facebook page, and that relating to the caller who called in about potato fruit from pollinated flowers. They look like small cherry-sized tomatoes. Roger says, I've seen them develop, but I've never tried to do anything with the seeds inside. Playing with the seeds could be fun, but I would not bet on the potato seeds producing a large potato crop next year. He has no idea, but he wouldn't bet. Let's put it that way.
Oh, and Roger would probably know. Roger has quite the vegetable garden and is very knowledgeable.
Very knowledgeable. And he reminds that tomatoes and potatoes are in the same family. The flowers and the pollinated fruit actually look fairly similar. And he's right about that. We have Jay in Plum City next with a question. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you doing, guys?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have shrubs called nine barks, and they're 4 to 6 feet tall. I've had them a few years, and previous years I've always had a little bit of powdery mildew, I believe, silvery, whitish stems and then some of the leaves. And this year, it seems like I have powdery mildew, at least on one plant. It was 90% covered, and the other ones are at least half covered, and I'm wondering, what's the best way to deal with that?
Well, you've already got it, and that's the problem, and I'm sure it is powdery mildew. As I mentioned earlier, our peonies were so covered with them, we cut the foliage right back to the ground. Powdery mildew is not going to harm the plant. It's going to be more of an aesthetic thing. If you don't like the looks of it, certainly you can apply fungicide, but if one of yours already has 90% covered, it's not a curative. It's just preventing further spread of the powdery mildew. If you really don't like the looks of it, you can get really drastic. Nine barks can be cut right back to the ground, and they'll flush out new growth. But it's going to take you another couple of years to get that same size. What most of us would probably do at this point is just, you know, deal with the fact that it has it. It's going to disappear as we get into hotter weather. But keep in mind, this is a year that is just ideal and perfect for diseases like powdery mildew.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks, Jay. And Claudia emailed us and said her tomatoes are showing just a small amount of blight. What can I do to, you know, stop the spread?
Well, there are solutions that you can purchase for that. But again, you probably should have been applying them before now. Since you're already seeing it start, it's probably going to be very difficult to prevent that from happening. Again, we're only just leaving that really overly wet, and then that tremendous humidity that followed that. So a lot of issues are going to hopefully start correcting themselves as we get into drier heat of the summer. Unfortunately, if we do see more heat with a lot more moisture, it's just going to be a year we're going to see a lot of these fungal-based diseases.
Jackie in Milwaukee, hello to you.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
My neighbor for many years has grown beautiful cannas along her garage. She gave me some of the tubers or bulbs, whatever you call them, but hers have never flowered, and the ones that you see in the middle of the boulevards have beautiful flowers on top. It says they're very heavy feeders. Now, I have a place I want to put them, but I'd like to see flowers.
I always laugh at the whole feeder thing because you don't feed plants, they create their own food. So that always makes me laugh. It could be that whatever particular canna you have to realize there are many different cannas out there, many different cultivars. You may have one that simply takes a longer growing season than we have to produce the flower. These are tropical plants, and believe it or not, we grow cannas in the garden. We don't even care about the flowers. We're growing them for the foliage. Yeah. Personally, I don't care for the flower. It seems almost minuscule above those great big bold foliage. But my suspicion is whatever cultivar you have takes a much longer growing season. When did you put them in?
I haven't put them in at all. They're in a bucket and they're growing.
Oh, okay. Well, that's part of the problem then.
And they're growing beautifully.
Yeah, if you want flowers, you need to get them in the ground as early as you possibly can. And again, there may be such a thing that you have a particular cultivar that still needs a longer growing season. Most of your cannas are, they may be selected for flowering earlier or the flower color.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of variety, a lot of differences in cannas.
Okay, yep. I'll enjoy the plant.
All right, Jackie, thank you for calling. And Janice in Shiocton. Thank you for calling. Hi.
You're welcome. I have a milkweed problem.
Okay.
Can I stop you first and ask you what milkweed we're talking about?
Oh, boy. Sure. Can't tell you, don't know. It's it's not swamp milkweed. They seem to be fine. I have a 6-acre bee yard that's loaded with milkweed, and I normally have tons of monarchs out there.
Okay, so we're just talking the common milkweed.
The common milkweed that you see in the ditches and in the fields.
Sure.
Okay, I have no monarchs this year. I had a pair briefly, and they left. I have monarchs up by the house, and they have the same problem. It seems, if it was a house plant, I'd say it got too much water. Some of the younger plants are yellowish, crinkled leaves. Some of the plants up by the house have crinkled leaves and a half a bloom. Other plants right next to it are blooming beautifully, but maybe have one or two crinkled leaves and yellowish.
That's interesting. It sounds like it could be a combination of problems. The yellowish, again, sounds like maybe too much water.
Like we had in the spring.
Right. Yeah. And crinkled leaves sounds like there could be an insect issue there that's attacking it. But I will be quick to tell you, I'm not an expert on milkweed and milkweed issues. This would be a question for somebody with some expertise in native plants, like Neil DeBoll from Prairie Nursery, maybe even the folks out at Johnson's Nursery out in Menominee Falls. It's a little beyond, I have to confess, issues with a native plant like milkweed. I'm not entirely sure I can give you an answer. My first suspicions would be you might have a combination of a water issue and an insect issue, but I'm guessing.
No.
So I would certainly maybe take some pictures of the problems you have and email to some of these folks that specialize in native plants. Make sure when you take the pictures, because I get these images all the time in email, that they're clear, they're good enough resolution, so that the person on the other end isn't sitting there and saying, I can't even see what it is that you're trying to show me. But that would be my advice, is contact somebody who specializes in native plants.
Yeah, Neil DeBoll in Prairie Nursery would be probably happy to answer that. But I think you're right, Ed. Kathy and Clayton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Last year I noticed on my asparagus fronds late in the season, hundreds of marmorated stink bugs. And I read about them and freaked out, and I cleaned up the garden really well in the fall, got everything off the garden so they wouldn't have a place to overwinter. But when I was out in the garden last week, I found nymphs of them. So they're back, and I understand they can be a huge problem. I know they leave those hard white spots in the flesh of tomatoes, and I understand they like other things too. So how do I get rid of them?
This is a Phil Pelletieri question, yeah. I think. Again, a little beyond my ornamental plant expertise. And I know our neighbors to the south are having some tremendous issues with stink bugs, and they are going to be an issue. I would contact UW Extension and Phil Pelletieri and see what Phil says to do, because I don't want to give you advice that's outside of my area of expertise.
If you go to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you can go online to that, and that's Phil. That's where Phil hangs his hat, so to speak, and he should be able to help you out. So thank you very much for calling. An email from Pam: thanks for the description of chlorosis. My petunias get this sometimes. Where do I get the remedy, the chelated iron?
Oh, you can get chelated iron at any, pretty much any garden center. And again, it'll come in a concentrated solution that you'll mix up according to the directions. And like I said, it's rather very quick. But your petunias might not just be chlorosis. Again, petunias really need quite a lot of nitrogen, and you might have more of a nitrogen problem than you do a chlorosis problem. And they petunias absolutely detest moisture. This is not a petunia year.
Yeah, no.
Petunia, lantana, there are certain plants right now that we have at the gardens that we thought were going to look absolutely gorgeous, and they're laying flat and yellowing. And I think quicker with the petunias, you've got more of a nitrogen issue than you do chlorosis.
Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Garden on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, our guest today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One of the joys of seeing a lovely garden is getting ideas for things we'd like to do on our own to our gardens. But once we get home and want to get started, you don't really know what to do. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Lucky to have an expert garden professional from the Allen Centennial Gardens with us today to answer your questions. He's got some suggestions, many suggestions. Ed Lyon directs the Allen Centennial Gardens. Really appreciate it when he comes by. Ed, always, always great to see you.
And it's always great to be here.
Appreciate it very, very much. Just wanted to mention, coming at one today, before we take your questions on gardening, I want to mention something that's coming up relating to NSA eavesdropping and Google sharing your personal life. Does that bother you? I hope you'll join Ira Flato on Science Friday for a look at how we can protect our privacy online. That's at 1 o'clock. But right now, Ed Lyon with us to answer your gardening questions. Alan in Cameron has been waiting a while, so let's go to him. Alan, hi.
Hi. My question's about a silver maple. I have a silver maple that's got the red bumps on the leaves, and from what I can have found, it's maple mites.
They're on the underside of the leaves, then.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, they're actually on the top.
They're on the top?
Yeah. And it covers probably up to half the tree. It varies. It's been varying the last couple of years, but it doesn't affect it. It just...
It's more of an aesthetic thing than you're saying. First off, I'm thinking, why would anybody care on a silver maple? Sorry to say that. I have two of them in my front yard, actually, and they're just a travesty as far as gardening is concerned. But anyways, I can't say as I've heard too much about red mites on silver maples. And usually when we have insect issues like that, they'll come one year because of certain cultural conditions, and then maybe not the next. But you're saying that you have this on a fairly regular basis, and it seems like it's increasing?
Yeah, it's been the last 3 years, and it's this year, like I said, it's up to half the leaves have it, and some of the leaves are fully engulfed.
Huh. I would again then recommend contacting the diagnostic labs at UW. Make sure that, you know, it's being diagnosed correctly. That is what it is. The best thing that you can do, I'm sorry, I didn't hear where you were from. Are you near the area?
Cameron.
Up north.
Oh, okay. So you're probably going to be best off by taking photographs and sending in. But again, try to give a series, not just send one photograph, but photographs that show a distance, close up. Send into the diagnostic lab. I mean, always ideally, the best thing is to be able to take a piece of that branch in, but you don't have that opportunity to do that unless you can do it through your local extension office. But I would try and get that diagnosed accurately and find out from the diagnostic lab what they would recommend for you.
So UW-Madison Diagnostic, Insect Diagnostic Lab, and they should be able to help you out with some, if you send some good photos.
Yep.
Good luck. Thanks, Alan. Bob in Eau Claire, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Wonderful. What's on your mind?
Well, we have got, or we had, Monarda and balloon flowers. And we had four really luxurious Monarda last year, and we had about 30 balloon flowers. And we do have an irrigation system, so they were adequately watered during the summer last year during the drought. This spring, we have one surviving Monarda, and it is looking pretty unhappy. It nowhere near as luxurious as last year. And I think we're down to six balloon flowers from the original 24 or 30 that we started with. And I'm wondering, is it either that despite our attempts to countermand the drought last year, that some of the drought conditions still affected them, or did that May snowstorm wipe them out?
No, I think it's quicker the drought, because Monarda actually like a fair amount of moisture. And I'll also approach your balloon flowers. Balloon flowers aren't especially robust plants in this area. They do best in really sandy, gravelly, well-drained soils. They don't like moisture at all. In fact,
what we have.
You have moisture, sand.
We are the OPEC of sand.
Oh, well, then you've actually
in Eau Claire County.
Well, then you've got ideal conditions for them. So what I'm thinking is, and I'll give you an example myself. I had Chinoski maple. In fact, I think myself and Olbrich Gardens are probably the only two places I've seen a Chinoski maple in the area. And I noticed last year during that drought, the foliage started to dry up. And I'm like, boy, I've got to really pour the water to it. And I watered and watered and watered that tree. I still lost it. There's a lot of plants. We think we're giving them adequate water. But through a drought period like that, you sometimes have to put that water on and simply it has to go and go and go, especially if you're doing overhead watering. People don't realize how much water when you're overhead watering it takes to thoroughly saturate that ground. In fact, at the gardens last year, we'd put out overhead watering. We'd let it go for literally hours, and I think, good, that'll at least get us through tomorrow. We won't be watering tomorrow. And we'd come in, and that drought was so bad. We were halfway through the day. I'm going, oh, my God, we have to water again. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking if you're in sandy soils, that's probably what did it. So, you know, I'd go out and just buy some new plants and put in, and with it not being a drought, let those establish. I think that's probably what happened to you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Marty in Douglas County, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon, you guys.
Good afternoon.
I was just visiting a friend over in Duluth and brought home a little snip of a spruce branch from one of her trees. She has lots of spruce trees, various varieties, native ones, some that she has planted. She talked to an arborist. She has talked to another tree expert. about something that seems to be happening from Duluth North in Minnesota. The new growth is coming in. I've got it here in front of me. It looks like an arthritic finger. It's straight, and then it just takes a curve, like a 90-degree turn. The needles are barely showing. They're maybe at most a quarter of an inch long. And this is happening to lots of her trees. I've walked around our property. We're south of Duluth a bit. I don't see that it's happening here. Have you heard of anything like this? They have talked to Extension in Minnesota, the U there. Like I said, this has been something her arborist has been observing for several years, and they have no clue what it could be.
Boy, the first thing that I would think is the insect. There are a number of different spruce-infecting insects that's where they go for right from the start, is that new growth, that emerging candle. And that would be my suspicion. When you first started saying it, I thought, oh, it's a homeowner. I thought pesticide drift, because that will also, or a chemical drift, herbicide. Because that will do it. But this sounds like it's over a fairly large region where a number of people are seeing it. And my first thought would be there's some type of insect in that area. And again, it needs to go to a diagnostic lab in order to identify exactly what insect it is. But that sounds, I'd be willing to put a hefty wager that there's an insect. And that's one of the, there's several different ones. That's where they go straight for. They'll lay their eggs right into that new growth, and it causes distortion. And very often, they won't even then needle out.
Yeah.
So do you think would you be able to find some evidence of insect activity, like you said, egg mass or something like that?
Yeah, and this is a case where it's really going to, taking pictures is not going to help you.
No.
You're going to want to get some of those branches cut off and somehow sent in fresh to a diagnostic lab so that they can look for evidence of eggs, damage. Damage to the vascular system that would indicate that it's a insect problem.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it sounds like to me, especially if it's happening over a large area, and more likely that than disease.
Yeah. So now that I've got this branch here at home with my trees, and I've got it in a plastic bag, should I just really tighten that bag up well and put it in my garbage?
Well, I'd contact a diagnostic lab and ask them how to send it,
if you want to send it in.
You want to send it in. Find out.
Okay, thanks so very much for your help there.
Yeah, yep. Thanks a lot for calling. An email from Susan, who says, we grow our eggplant under floating row covers because of flea beetle issues. This year we put each individual plant under its own cover in a tomato cage rather than all the plants together under one cover. Is eggplant self-pollinating, or do we need to remove the individual covers during flowering if we want eggplants?
You know, I don't know if it's self-pollinating or not.
No, neither.
You've got both of us stumped.
I am not sure. I only have one eggplant.
Yep. I would think if you did a Google search, you could find out whether it's self-pollinating or needs cross-pollination.
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. And I have one in my straw bale garden, the one straw bale that I have. I thought, oh, I'll put an eggplant in there and just see.
Well, if it's not self-pollinating, you're probably not going to get any eggplants there, Larry.
We've got an email from Barb in Green Bay, who has a 2-year-old Arrowwood Viburnum, Autumn Jazz. It's growing just great, gets only a few flowers, no fruit. Do I need another Viburnum for pollination? Or if so, another arrowwood or another kind of viburnum?
Well, if you're going to get another one, it would then need to be another dentata, the arrowwood. It really shouldn't need another one. Now, my first inclination, if you're not getting, I actually have that very same viburnum in my own home garden. I have three of them. My first thought is you don't have enough sun. The plant is very shade tolerant, so as a result, many people plant it in the shade. But it will also reduce the amount of flowers and the fruit that will set. Ideal conditions for it for maximum flower and fruit, which is true of many plants, even if they're shade tolerant, is to get a lot of sunlight. And that would be my first suspicion is she's probably growing it in an area that's shaded because they're very often sold as a shade tolerant plant.
1-800-642-1234, the number for you to call to join in. Gary in Ashland online. Hi, Gary.
Hi, hi.
What's on your mind?
Two questions. How do you get rid of mint, and how do you get rid of snow on the mountain? And by the way, I've got some plants I'll give away.
Well, don't give them to us because we don't want them. First off, I'm assuming is snow on the mountain, you're talking about Agapodium, which is also called bishop's weed. That's a horrible, horrible plant to try and get rid of. In fact, the best description of that plant I've ever seen is the single line that the Flower Factory has in their catalog, and it says contain in concrete. And I think I would contain it in wet concrete and let it form around it. It's very difficult to get rid of both because they're both sending out rhizomes. And when you go to dig that, any little piece of rhizome that stays behind is going to regenerate new plant. I am not a very big advocate of using herbicides or pesticides, but this is one instance where if it's a situation where that is the only plant and it's not growing in a flower bed or something of that nature, then you can do it organically by covering it with black plastic and letting the soil heat up. It may take you 2 years, though, to completely kill off the root systems of those plants. They're very tough. There's a lot. They can store a lot of energy in those root systems. However, if you're trying to eliminate it from some other area where you have other plants, you may have to go the herbicide route. If you do, one of my suggestions is I really hate to see people spraying herbicides. That chemical ends up airborne. In fact, I have a real issue right now with the Roundup commercials with a guy who's the cowboy standing there shooting Roundup, you know, 20 feet away. That particulate matter ends up in the air, ends up all over. What we do is we mix up the appropriate chemical at the gardens, and we use very little. And then we put on a vinyl glove and then a soft glove. And we will take and dip our hands in the chemical, and then we run it along the foliage of that plant. And if that plant's in amongst other plants, we may put newspaper or something around the plant so it doesn't get in our other plants. But at least this way we know that that chemical is going on that plant and that plant only, and then goes down into the root system. But you've got two plants that are quite difficult to eliminate.
Absolutely. Good luck, Gary. You're going to need a little bit of luck and a lot of work there. We have Virginia in Webster up next. Hi, Virginia.
We like to buy all-purpose plant food for our garden and flowers, and we've noticed there's a difference in the formula. Once of 24-8-16, now we're noticing 20-20-20 come out in almost the same packaging. What is the best to use is all-purpose?
And it depends on what you're using it for, but we mentioned this earlier in this show. I am not an advocate of the ones that are even balanced.
20-20-20, for example.
Right, because, again, plants take up each of those nutrients at a different rate. So if you're putting down, and they'll take up nitrogen far faster than potassium and phosphorus. They also need less potassium and phosphorus. So if you're putting down a 20-20-20, there's a lot of that potassium and phosphorus the plant doesn't need. It won't take up and leaches into our soils, and we don't need those kinds of concerns. Basically, one of the things to look at is nitrogen is mostly for vegetative growth. So we put on higher concentrations of nitrogen earlier in the season to get that vegetative growth. You need to back off on that, particularly in vegetables and things of that nature later in the season, because you're going to get vegetative growth at the expense of flower and fruit. And then potassium, the higher levels of potassium are for root development. That's where a plant needs it. That's why you'll see for lawns, for instance, they'll put higher levels of potassium on in the fall because you're trying to get stronger roots to go through the winter. Can I recommend a book for you? And I recommend this to every single gardener out there. It's called Teeming with Microbes. And it's written by Jeff Lowenfels and somebody else. Jeff is actually a friend of mine. He's from Alaska. He's got the longest running radio garden talk show Larry might be interested in, in the country. And he wrote this book called Teeming with Microbes. He has a brand new one just released called Teeming with Nutrients. But it is probably the best little book for any home gardener to truly understand soils, organic matter, and nutrition for plants. And
we should try to post that up on our Facebook page, a copy of that, so that we can, so people can see.
Yep, because it's not the same fertilizer for every plant or for the same part of the season. You need specific formulations for different times of the year and different plants.
We know that it's even much more difficult to find the 24-8-16. It seems like the shelves now are full of 20-20-20.
That's odd because good old Miracle-Gro is like 28% nitrogen, and Miracle-Gro is very easy to find.
Yeah, there you go. Virginia, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ed, wanted to mention, go back to the Allen Gardens, because you've got something new going, which I think is really pretty cool and exciting, the Friends, a new Friends organization.
That's correct. A lot of people don't realize we're 100% operationally self-funded, and that includes my salary, my benefits. We have to raise all of the money that it takes to run Allen Centennial Gardens. There's not a dime of taxpayer or state money that goes into that. So in order to do more outreach, education, and hold events, we formed a new Friends group. And that Friends group has put together a membership program. And we'd love to have people join and become members. It's relatively inexpensive. It's $25 for an individual, $45 for a family. In addition to supporting the gardens, you get a reciprocal agreement with gardens all over the country. I teach classes in the wintertime, which previously were only for volunteers. Now our Friends members can attend those classes. But we have some events that we're going to be doing. We have a fun rare plant auction that we're going to do for fundraising next year. We have a symposium event coming up this September. So if you become a Friends member, you know all the you'll be on a list, and you'll get notification when we're doing all these kind of new and interesting outreach opportunities.
We have that, and that's wonderful. And you can go to my Facebook page, actually, at the Larry Mueller Show. We've got a link to the Allen Centennial Gardens.
Yep, and there is a very specific page right on there that will tell you about the membership program, the benefits that it offers. So we'd love to have all of you join us and help support the gardens and take advantage of all the different benefits that we'll also get out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Judith, already in her usual efficient way, already has a link to that book that you mentioned up on our Facebook page. So that's up there as well. And certainly we hope that you will take a look at that book. And again, the title of it was, do you remember?
Teeming with Microbes.
Teeming with Microbes.
Right. And we've learned so many new things about soils and the fact that it's a living thing. And a previous caller mentioned something about, well, we had soil brought in. Well, we're learning what soil truly is. It's more than quote unquote dirt. It's a living thing. Again, many people asking about fertilizers. In my own perennial garden at home, I never use fertilizer. It's about getting organic matter into your garden. And the more organic matter you get, the happier those plants are. And it provides nutrition in a much better form than these inorganic fertilizers we've been formulating.
Ed, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, our guest on Garden Talk.